Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elena McGrath.
With me today is Frederico Freitas, who is an associate professor of history at North Carolina State University. He is the author of Nationalizing Nature, Iguazu Falls and the National Parks at the Brazil-Argentina Border, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. He is also the co-editor of Big Water, The Making of the Borderlands Between Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay, out from University of Arizona Press in 2018. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you for having me. It's a great, I'm very happy to be here talking to about my book with you.
Wonderful. Well, can you start by telling us a little bit about your own background and how you came to this project?
Yeah, sure. I'm from Brazil, and I had a career as a graphic designer doing graphic design and animation in Brazil for about 10 years, and then I decided to return to academia. And then eventually I came to the United States to do my PhD. And I always had interest in environmental history and also in the history of the Atlantic Forest. I can talk more about the Atlantic Forest later on. And when I was in grad school, when I'm doing my PhD, I knew I wanted to do something with environmental history of Brazil. Something related to the Atlantic Forest, the history of the Atlantic Forest in Brazil. And I started to look into possible topics. And I had this a couple of years ago in Brazil. I was touring with this hardcore punk band in South America. And I remember when we were coming back from Argentina, traveling from Buenos Aires to Sao Paulo by bus. And I remember that I noticed that when we are getting close to the border in Argentina, getting close to the border in Brazil, and I look around, everything was forest. And as the moment that we crossed the border, everything changed, the landscape changed. It was everything farms. And that fact stayed in the back of my mind. So when I was years later, I was in the United States, I was at Stanford trying to figure out what my topic would be. I remembered that. And then I went online and went to Google Maps and looked online a satellite image of this region. And at a time, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, you could see stark difference and the landscape in these satellite images between the Brazilian side of the border and the Argentine side of the border. And then I decided I'm going to do an environmental history of this borderland. This borderland is known as the Triple Frontier, the Triplice Frontera, Triple Frontera. And it's the borderland between Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay. And it's kind of like famous borderland in South America. So I thought it would be a great opportunity because there's like the borders and there's different social, historical, environmental processes happening at each side of the border. So I thought I'm going to do an environmental history of this borderland. It turns out that you always start with a very big, wide, bold project, and then you end up narrowing down it to something more manageable. So I end up focusing on these two national parks that were created at this borderland in the 1930s, one in Argentina, one in Brazil, to protect this massive waterfalls that exist there, the Iguazu Falls, because there was something more manageable. I could use that, the history of these two parks, as a window to talk more about the larger region as a whole. That's how I started with this project. And it was interesting because I'm not from that region of Brazil. I'm from São Paulo, big city. I've never, I don't have any experience there. I don't have family connections there, but it was interesting to look at that region as sort of an outsider. And that's how I got interested in this topic.
As an outsider in a hardcore punk band trying to cross the border, that's an excellent origin story for thinking about what borderlands mean and landscapes, changing landscapes. For listeners who may also be outsiders who have never been to this region, what makes the landscape of Iguazu Falls, the Triple Frontier, and so unique? And what is the Atlantic Forest?
Okay, so this is a really interesting question. So that region is dominated by the Paraná River, which is part of the Paraná River Basin, which is the second largest river basin in South America after the Amazon River Basin. It's a huge river basin. And the Iguazu Falls, they are waterfalls that are on the Iguazu River, which is one of the main tributaries of the Paraná River at that region. And the Iguazu River in its final stretch makes the border between Brazil and Argentina. The falls itself are really interesting. There are these massive falls. For the sake of comparison, they are bigger than the Niagara Falls. And they are not only bigger, but they are more interesting, at least from my own opinion, because they have hundreds of, they are divided into hundreds of individual falls. So it's this massive complex of individual waterfalls. And like Niagara, they are binational waterfalls. They are divided between Brazil and Argentina. And today they're one of the most visited places, visited by tourists in Brazil and Argentina. So there you have like a massive tourism industry built around visitation to these waterfalls. The larger area where they are located, which they are known as the Triple Frontier, they have been an area of colonial dispute between Spain and Portugal for centuries. Since colonial times, they were also an area where in the 17th century, you had some Jesuit settlements there, Jesuit/Guarani settlements there that had been attacked by people from the captaincy of São Paulo. For the people from São Paulo were slave raiders. Later on, you have the War of the Triple Alliance in the 19th century, which pitted Argentina and Brazil against Paraguay, and a lot of that happened in this larger area of the Triple Frontier. And up until the 1950s, this area was still a frontier, in that beginning in the 1950s, different parts of the border started to be colonized by different groups. In the case of Brazil, you have settlers, mostly white Brazilian settlers of European descent, mostly German Brazilians or Italian Brazilians, coming from other parts of the country, from the south, from the state of Rio Grande do Sul, moving to that area, clearing the forest and creating farms. Eventually, some of them will cross the border into Paraguay. And you also have on the Argentine side, in a different timeline, also some colonization projects happening in the province of Misiones. And in this area, you also have, in the 1970s, one of the largest infrastructure projects in South America starting there, which is the Itaipu Dam, which is this largest hydroelectric dam, which at the time that it was built, it was finished in 1982. At the time that it was finished, it was the largest hydroelectric dam in the world. It was split between Brazil and Paraguay. And the building of the Itaipu marks the shift of Paraguay from a country that historically was deeply connected to Argentina, and it started to be deeply connected to Brazil, not only because of Itaipu, but also because of highways and other things. Today, beginning in the 1980s, 1990s, the Paraguayan side of this borderland started to be this center of commerce, of imported goods, and also a center of counterfeit goods. You have a lot of Chinese influence as China becomes to industrialize itself. It starts to become more influential in this border area. And also, with the war on terror, there was this concern by U.S. authorities that area would become a center of international terrorism, because there is a community of immigrant community from Shia Lebanese there, and they were afraid that would become a center of like international terrorism for some reason. The Atlantic Forest. Let's talk a little bit about the Atlantic Forest. So the Atlantic Forest, Mata Atlântica, how we call it in Portuguese, is this large swath of tropical and subtropical rainforest that exists in Brazil and is separate from the Amazon. But like the Amazon, it's highly biodiverse. You have several endemic species that can only be found in the Atlantic Forest. Encompasses a huge swath of coastal Brazil, the eastern seaboard of Brazil. Used to be covered by Atlantic Forest. Originally, there's estimates that the area of the Atlantic Forest, when the Portuguese first arrived in Brazil in the 16th century, covered over 600 square miles, which is an area the size of Alaska. And this is the area where most of the Portuguese colonization initially occurred in Brazil. You have all the classic cycles of colonial and 19th century commodities happening in areas of Atlantic Forest, things like sugarcane, gold, coffee, and also later on in the 20th century, industrialization all happened in parts that used to be covered by Atlantic Forest. Over 70% of Brazilian population still lives in areas that used to be covered by the Atlantic Forest. Big cities like Rio, São Paulo are in areas of the Atlantic Forest. And today, most of the forest is gone. There's only 5% left, and divided into small fragments. And it became this sort of like, in Brazilian environmental history, became this sort of a cautionary tale for what could happen if you let development occur without checks. became this classic theme, the most famous work on the history of the Atlantic forest is with Broadex and Firebrand by the late Warren Dean. And a lot of works on the environmental history of Brazil deal with the Atlantic forest. And I was interested in doing that. And I was interested in looking at this. I became interested in looking at this part of the Atlantic forest that is located at this western frontier of Brazil that is usually not very looked at by the literature, because it expands into Paraguay, into Argentina, and people, Brazilianists who look at the Atlantic forest, they think of the Atlantic forest as this type of biome that's only Brazilian, but when in fact it also can also find Atlantic forest like biological formations in Paraguay and Argentina. And my book kind of look at that by focusing on these two parks at this borderland.
Yeah, I think that explanation is really helpful, and it brings together so many things, but at least three things that are so crucial to your book. One is the state of the frontier as an area of national security concern, but then also the state of the forest as an area of longstanding biodiversity concern and sort of natural, something that is unique or seen to be unique to Brazil. But then as you point out in the book, the kind of the question of preserving biodiversity and nature really opens up the question of what belongs to a nation. So let's talk about some of the terms in which you make your argument. One of the phrases that I really like that you use is the geopolitics of nature preservation. And as someone who is who works a little bit in environmental history myself, but you know, when people generally think about the national park and the kind of heroic myth and history of it, they think about Yellowstone, they think about preserving pristine wilderness, protecting biodiversity. Of course, Yellowstone has its own history that goes far beyond that, as you point out, and many others too. But your book argues compellingly that the story of the Brazilian and Argentine national parks on both sides of the waterfalls is as much about the creation and maintenance of secure international borders as it is about conservation, and also that conservation is a preoccupation with being able to surveil and control what happens in a particular space. So it is also about controlling territory. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So by the time the two countries created national parks at this borderland, first motivation to create the national parks was to preserve the waterfalls. The waterfalls were already the feature that attracted attention to this specific location. There were people visiting, and it was a waterfall that by law, by an international treaty, was divided between the two countries. So you have this sort of like dynamic that happens connecting people on the two sides of the border, in which every time one side decided to do something to preserve the waterfall, like pass a law or expropriate land, the other side would do the same. But beyond that, the two parks, they were not limited to the waterfalls and to the immediate area surrounding the waterfalls, but they also expanded to other parts of this region. And by doing that, they end up protecting large expanses of the Atlantic forest. One thing that I found out when I look at the debate about creating these parks in the 1930s on the two sides of the border is that although concerns about the conservation of the forest were in the mind of many people who were proposing these parks to be created, there were also other concerns, and these are primarily geopolitical. Brazil and Argentina had been this kind of like rivals in South America for many decades, for many years. And this area, although the borders of this area were already set by the time these parks were created, this area had a history of a border or a border conflict between the two countries. And by the time they were discussing the creation of these two parks, people were also discussing on the two sides of the border the fact that this area was sparsely populated. This area, the borders at this region were porous. People were crossing the border all the time. In the case of Brazil, for example, you had these Argentine firms that were exploiting wild yerba mate on the Brazilian side, and they would employ a labor force that was primarily Guarani, native Brazilian. And you have all this Brazilian government employees who were traveling to this region, and they would write this report saying there was an absurd that we're traveling in Brazilian territory and could not find people who spoke Portuguese only. People were only speaking Spanish or Guarani, and Brazil needed to do something to nationalize that border. So the creation of the Brazilian park was envisioned as a way to use the park as a tool to funnel investment to nationalize that border. And it's the same in Argentina. In Argentina, it's even more extreme in that the Argentines, when they created the park, they also created an entire national park system with a national park legislation. And they envisioned this national park system as a way to nationalize not only that border with Brazil, but other borders that Argentina had, like the border with Chile. So they created the Nahuelhuapi National Park. And they envisioned, they set into law instruments to use the national park structure that they had just created to nationalize the border. So one of the things that they did was to provide in a law that each national park that was set to be created at the border would have a section of the national park that would be used for colonization purposes. The national park agents would create settlements, would create towns, would sell lots for settlers, and would sell both urban lots and agrarian lots. They would establish infrastructure for this settlements, would establish services, hospitals, schools. And the National Park Agency would manage these settlements. So that's something that was unique. You don't see that happening in other examples of national park in other countries. You only see that in Argentina and in a lesser scale in Brazil. In Brazil, they didn't do that to that scale, but they used money that was destined to the national park to develop the towns and the border towns that they had in the region, to create also to open highways, to create hospitals, to create to build airports and all that. So what you have here, a very clear example of national parks being used for to promote development, not only development in terms of tourism, but development in terms of like actual settlement and colonization of areas that were deemed as sparsely populated. And this is pretty interesting because I think there's a case to be made that national parks are a type of development. And they can, and the way that these countries see these national parks was that they saw the national parks as a way to bring development to the borderland and to plant a flag at the border to demonstrate that from now on, that border had been nationalized, had been the nation state had taken control of their border, and the national park was one of the things that they're using to do that. And a lot of times when we think about national parks, we focus so much in conservation that we forget the fact that national parks are, at the end of the day, they are national. They are supposed to be this national symbol, the symbol for the nation. And in the case of these two national parks, this is pretty clear.
I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about your book was starting with the creation of these parks as you call them, paper parks, right? Where the national government just says, these belong to us. And you cite examples of people trekking out to see them and seeing maybe a sign on a tree, but nothing else, right? And so one of the things your book does really well is show that when you say national parks are nationalizing, that there's an infrastructure built. And I think that case for it as a form of development makes sense. And as a way of encouraging settlement, as you say. So who was settling in this area? And then when did that preoccupation with putting people into the park change to a preoccupation with controlling access?
So in the case of Argentina had a very explicit policy of using the park that he had created there to promote colonization. So they had this model of the type of person they wanted to attract. Ideally would be an Argentine national born in Argentina. There's some debates about whether or not they would accept immigrants from Europe to settle there, but there's some people who were against that because they thought that because that was an area of that could be influenced by neighboring countries, they wanted to make sure the people who settled there were actually Argentines. So they wanted to bring Argentines. They had this model of like nuclear family. Ideally, they would be married couples of Argentines who would settle there, people who would buy lots either in the town that they created there that eventually became Puerto Iguazu, or in the some rural lots that they had inside of the national park for sale. And they had also this model of behavior that they expect the settlers to follow. Like they're supposed to work, they're not supposed to be unemployed, they cannot drink, they should go to church, all this kind of thing. And of course, when they try to force settlers to fit into that model, things, that's when you have the conflicts because people didn't follow this model and all that. So I talk a little bit about that in my book. On the Brazilian side, they didn't need to create a settlement inside the territory of the Brazilian National Park because they already had a town nearby, a town that was created as a development project before the creation of the national park. That town became Foz do Iguaçu. And also because Brazil, this part of Brazil, a couple of years after the park was created, was already the target of a colonization project. But in Brazil, what you have is you had a dispute between the federal government and the state government on who owned the public land that was used to create the national park. And that dis- dispute dragged on for a couple of years. And while this dispute is being disputed in courts, you have colonization ways of settlers coming from other parts of Brazil. These are the white Brazilian settlers of German and Italian descent that I talked before. And this part of Brazil, of Western Paraná, that's the name of the state there, it was an area that had a lot of, they had a history of land conflict, a history of land grabbing, of conflict over land, of colonization companies selling land with dubious land titles for settlers and then expelling them and selling the land again. And you also have a history of settler uprisings in this part of Brazil. So because of this, all this land incertitude, this dispute between federal government and state government, and this history of land violence, you had a process in that you had people starting to sell land inside the national park that had been created 10, 20 years ago in Brazil to settlers with fake deeds. And so you have a lot of settlers settling inside a section of the national park in Brazil, and that will become a problem that would be solved in the 1970s with the relocation and removal of the settlers. So these are the type of people who are settling inside the two parks. Settlers in the case of Brazil, settlers from other parts of Brazil. In the case of Argentina, settlers that are being attracted by the National Park Agency that they hoped it were like fit in that model that they created. What was the second part of the question that you asked?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So the second part of the question was, after at what point did the policy around encouraging certain kinds of people to settle change? And I actually think this would be a great time to go into another question I had for you, which is your book thinks a lot about what it means that the military regimes in both Brazil and Argentina had very significant relationships with these parks, right? And had a huge impact on the policy changes in these parks. So do you want to talk a little bit about the military regimes and what happened in the 70s?
Sure. I think that's a great question. So since the beginning, when the parks were created in the 1930s, you had people and the National Park Agency in Argentina and the Forest Service in Brazil who thought that these parks should be used to protect the forests, to protect nature. So you have, but these are like a minority voice in the two countries at a time. By the late 1950s, the 1960s, the people who were advocating for nature protection to be the primary goal of these parks, had became the main people in charge of these national parks. There's a generational change, and the people, the first national park proponents, they retired, they died. So you have these people who are like, they're like forestry people, agronomists. And these are the people who think that national parks should actually be used to primarily to protect nature. At the same time, you have this shift, this debate internationally. You have these meetings at the IUCN, which is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and the people who are in charge of taking care of national parks, both in Brazil and Argentina, they are connected to this community, this larger international community. And at these meetings, you have debates about people trying to define what is a national park, because you have different countries and different parts of the world creating national parks, and they are all are created in different ways. So you have this debate about what is a national park, and that's when at this level, they decide to define national parks as these places without people, where people should not live, that places that were territories that were devised to protect nature exclusively. So in the 1960s, you have this sort of like paradigm shift happening both internationally and nationally in Brazil and Argentina. And you start to see this push to remove all the people who are living both in the national park in Argentina and in the national park in Brazil from the area of the national park. In Argentina, that would be a more challenging process, because in Argentina, they not only had settlers, but they also have an entire town existing inside the territory of the national park. So one of the things that they did was to retrace the boundaries of the national park to remove the town from the area of the national park. They gave the management of the town to the province of Misiones. And they also removed some of the settlers that were living in other parts of the national park, close to where the waterfalls are located. They send these people to the town that they had just removed from the territory of the park. In Brazil, things were more complicated, because you have about 2,500 people living as settlers living inside the Brazilian park. They had farms they had created. They have schools, they had churches, they had soccer teams, and people were for a while Brazilian people working at the Brazilian agencies that dealt with the national parks. They were discussing whether or not they should just split apart the national park into two parts and have the middle part where the people were living as non-national park, or if they just try to expel these people. And they eventually decided to expel these people. There's an entire debate about it would not bode well to the Brazilian state to not be able to remove people from a national park, because that would be demonstrated the Brazilian state and the Brazilian government had no capacity to force people away from a territory that it controlled, especially in an area of in a border area, in an area that was at the time deemed as of national security interest. So they go for the idea of removing these people. It turns out that all these changes, they happen on both sides of the border at a time that the two countries were controlled by military dictatorship. In the case of Brazil, you have the military dictatorship that happened, that started in 1964 with a coup. And between 1964 and 1985, Brazil is controlled by different military governments, and that's the government that carried out this removal of settlers from the Brazilian park. And in Argentina, you also have that happened primarily at the time of the Argentine Revolution, which is this period of military control of Argentina that happens in the mid-1960s all the way to the early 1970s. And some settlers linger in the Brazilian, in the Argentine park, and eventually are removed by the second military dictatorship during the Dirty War. So that shows that to remove the settlers, what you have was a top-down process that used some of the tools, some of the violent and authoritarian tools of these that were at hand by these military dictatorships to remove these people. In the case of Brazil, they not only use this more authoritarian tools, violent tools, but also they used the agrarian reform structure that had been built by the Brazilian military dictatorship to remove the settlers. When the Brazilian military dictatorship started, one of the things that they recognized was that they would need to do an agrarian reform. And the way that they chose to do an agrarian reform was by doing an agrarian reform by promoting colonization. That's when they started to send people to the Amazon in colonization projects. They recognized that there was a lot of people without land in Brazil. And instead of expropriating large latifundia, they decided to not touch that and just send people to frontier areas to give them land. And they used that those legal and policy tools to remove the people from the Brazilian National Park from within the National Park. They used the National Park as a sort of a test case for this type of new policies. And you have a lot of violence, people being arrested, people resisting, people being sent to jail because they're resisting removal, people being threatened with torture, all the kind of things that is common throughout this period in both Brazil and Argentina.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, the ways that, as you say, the military governments were able to use the parks to try out policy, but then also the military governments had the infrastructure to control the parks in ways that maybe earlier governments had not done. So let's talk a little bit about how this example or how the Brazilian and the Argentine cases compare to other histories of national parks. So for example, there's a growing literature on Mexican national parks and their entanglement with the revolutionary state, or on U.S. national parks, of course. So how does this case compare with those?
That's a really interesting question. So in the case of the United States, a lot of the literature since the 90s on national parks had tried to focus on national parks as acts of displacement. They tried to focus on the peoples who were displaced by the creation of these protected areas, indigenous people or rural people who were created, who were displaced, or who no longer had access to the natural resources encircled by the creation of these national parks. And they have tried to uncover that, cast a light on that history, because that's usually a history that is concealed by the standard discourse on national park, the type of discourse that you see on official literature by the National Park Service and all that. I think that has changed in recent years, but up until the 90s and the 2000s, the normal narrative about national parks was that they were created to protect wilderness. This idea that wilderness were these primeval natural regions that never had human habitation in them, and this idea that you had to recreate this, bring nature to this pristine state without humans. And the literature, this new literature on national parks in the United States, were trying to point out that in fact people always lived in these areas. People always used the resources of this area, the natural resources existing in these areas that were protected. And by creating parks that were deemed to be parks without people, they were actually displacing and preventing people from having access to these protected areas other than as a tourist or as a scientific researcher. In the case of Mexico, what you have is in the 1930s, you have parks being created in Mexico, as you have parks being created in Argentina and Brazil and Chile. But in Mexico, the parks that were created, they were created in the context of the post-revolutionary of post-revolutionary ideas. So you have this push for agrarian reform. You have this idea that any kind of policy, any kind of agrarian policy needs to serve the needs of the people who are living on the land. So the parks that were created in Mexico, they were created to that in mind. So they did not, at this moment, were designed to remove people. They were designed to preserve natural resources that will be used by this agrarian rural population that were living inside or nearby these parks. In Argentina, you have this paradigm that's totally different. Parks are created to colonize borderlands, and they are going to be used as these tools of colonization. In Brazil, you have a more haphazard standard in that some of the parks are created to develop borderlands, to develop frontiers. You have that in the case of Iguazu in the 1930s and 1940s. You also have some parks that are created to develop frontiers in the 1960s in central Brazil, as you have this push to develop central Brazil. You have the construction of Brasilia, the new capital city. You also have the creation of several national parks in that area of Brazil. And in the 1970s, when the military regime devised all these plans for development and colonization of the Amazon, included in these plans, you also have the creation of some national parks. These are the first national parks that are created by Brazil in the Amazon. They were created by the military regime in the 1970s as part of this push to develop the Amazon. So you have that, but I also have national parks created in other parts of Brazil for other reasons. So the Brazilian system, maybe because Brazil is so big, the Brazilian system is less, was less coherent up until the 1980s.
Yeah, that makes sense. Brazil has a huge and very diverse landscape. Has unique challenges to control of that landscape. So my next question for you is kind of about the way you structure the book itself, and particularly the last two chapters of the book, because the first several chapters sort of tell a coherent binational story where you're talking about similar processes as they play out in Brazil and Argentina. But the last two chapters take a different kind of approach. And so in the sixth chapter, you're looking at surveillance practices as repeated practices that produce a landscape. And in your seventh, you use aerial imaging to look at the landscape transformation. So can you talk first about what made you organize this information in this way, and then a little bit about what this look helps us understand?
Okay. So when I sat down to write, this book was, came from my PhD dissertation, and, the structure was already in place. So I developed this structure while I was doing my PhD dissertation. And one of the challenges when I sat down to write this story was how to deal with the fact that you have things happening on two sides of the border at the same time. One of the things that I realized in the process is that this was both a comparative history and also a connected history. A comparative because I was comparing the two sides of the border, and also because historical actors on the two sides of the borders were comparing, were looking at what was happening on the other side of the border, and was acting in response to that. So you have this kind of like national park race, the race to see who was going to create the national parks first. So the actors themselves are comparing, are seeing what's happening across the border. But this is also a connected history, not only connected by the fact that you have a borderland, that people are crossing the border all the time, but also because the parks, although they developed totally independent from each other, they develop because of each other. And at first, I was trying to write chapters each chapter would tell parts of this history of the creation of parks in parallel, the same chapter, but that didn't work out. And then I create this structure where I have two chapters about Brazil, two chapters about Argentina, and I go back and forth, and that made it easier for me to tell this story. The fifth and the sixth chapters, they are different in that I try to talk about, I go deeper into the connections between the two sides of the border, and I try to talk about the two sides of the border at the same time. So the fifth chapter is about poaching and hunting and heart of palm harvesting inside the parks. And one of the things that it's interesting about this parks is that the parks have their boundaries, they have their national park boundaries, but they also have an international boundary that divides them, the boundary between Brazil and Argentina. So when you have people from one side of the border, for example, people from Brazil crossing the border to enter the national park in Argentina and poach there happening, you have a series of like border crossings that are happening at the same time. So I noticed that happening. So one example of that, people would cross the border to poach or, okay, let's start again. So one example of that, park rangers in Argentina were continuously accusing Brazilians of crossing the border to enter the national park in Argentina and hunt there. And when I was reading their reports, I was not 100% sure these people were actually Brazilian. But eventually I did some deeper research and I found out that all these people were Brazilian. And they were doing that because the legislation in Argentina was not as severe as in Brazil. And also because once they cross the border back to Brazil, people in Argentina, rangers in Argentina, they didn't have the means to prosecute the people who were poaching in Argentina, the Brazilians who were poaching in Argentina. So the border gave them this protection. They would not be deported back to Argentina to be prosecuted there. So we have this all this border dynamics happening that I was trying to show in this chapter, and it was necessary for me to talk about the two sides of the border at the same time. I was following rangers. I was trying to understand how these parks were created as spaces of nature protection on the ground, what kind of spatial practices were necessary to create these parks as spaces of protection. So I follow the national park rangers as they travel through the outback of these parks. They travel, they patrol these parks, so they're trying to follow them, doing that, trying to understand not only how these parks were created by planners, by people who were making the maps, but also by people on the ground trying to enforce these parks, these places as protected areas. In the case of my last chapter, when I was doing my PhD at Stanford, one of the things that I did was to get involved with the spatial history initiative there. So we have, at the time I was there, I have this lab that was doing a lot of spatial history work with GIS. And I know I wanted to do something with that, with this book. And when I was in Brazil, I stumbled upon, on an archive there, I stumbled upon this collection of aerial images that were produced by the government of the state of Paraná in 1953 that surveyed the entire region of the state. So they had these high-definition images of the park in 1953, which was right before settlers had entered the park. And they also had some images that were produced at the park in 1980. So I decided to use that to reconstruct the landscape before and after the creation of the Brazilian park, but before and after the occupation of the park by settlers, to understand changes in the landscape. And eventually I end up also using some images that were produced by this spy satellite program by the United States called Corona in the 1960s to see how the landscape of the park looked like in the 1960s. And that allowed me to look at this borderland from above, look at this borderland as a whole in a different scale, in a scale that usually my written sources didn't allow me to do it, to have this grand vision of this borderland, both in terms of like diachronically and synchronically, in terms of like the landscape and also in terms of like the time, and told the history of the change in landscape in this borderland throughout these decades, both inside the national parks and outside and surrounding area. And that's how I finished the book with this last chapter.
I think that's really interesting, the way that you bring it back kind of to your bring it back to the visual analysis and to looking at the landscape and using these images as sources. I think that's a really cool aspect of this particular book.
This is something that I don't know why, but environmental historians, at least those trained as historians, for some reason, they haven't used aerial images and satellite images as sources as much as they should. This is interesting because when you look at other disciplines like archaeology, for example, they use historical aerial images to identify historical sites before development happened in the last 50 years. But for some reason, environmental historians have not used those type of sources. And I think I was one of the first people to use that, at least that I know. I don't know, like the first environmental historian to use that aerial images to try to reconstruct past landscapes. You have people from other disciplines that do some sort of like environmental history, but they're not trained as historians. But the historians haven't used that, and they're not. And I hope that they start using that more, because beginning in the 1940s, 1950s, you have large parts of the globe being surveyed by aircraft, and later by satellites, and you have all these sources that could be used not only for environmental history but all sorts of different types of history. And I hope more historians start to use those type of sources.
There's a real explosion of information actually available for the more recent stages of history. That's a good point. And it does go along with both the advancement of technology and then also the advancement of sort of security concerns on the parts of states.
And state capacity too.
Yeah, state capacity. That makes sense. So I want to, my final question about the book is kind of about this tension between when you're talking about nature and the nation. Because as you note in the book, if you're going to try to control poaching, if you're going to think about biodiversity, if you want to talk about the Atlantic forest, these are things that are not contained by national borders. So it's a story in some cases of collaborating across borders. But as you note, there's this continued reticence to do too much collaborating. This isn't a peace park, as you know, right? These two parks have not created a kind of shared space of easy travel across. It's one of the more controlled tourist destinations that you can go to in Brazil. So how did thinking about these spaces as national parks change the way that Brazil and Argentina related to each other? And then how do those border negotiations sort of continue in the present day?
That's a great question. So when I was there doing at the border, doing my research, I interviewed a lot of different people there on the two sides of the border, national park, rangers, and the directors of the parks, people working for the national park agencies, people who worked for the parks before, like retired employees who had started working in the 1940s, 1950s, people from surrounding communities. And I got a sense that despite the fact that this, especially from the 2000s on, when you have the creation of the Mercosur, which is the common economic market between Brazil and Argentina, and for locals, even for any Brazilian or Argentine national, crossing the border is not much of a big deal. You can cross with your ID. You don't need a passport. And have a lot of people crossing the border, all sides of the border, including Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay, all the time. Despite all that, despite all this integration, despite this, the border being pretty open and porous for nationals of the three countries, you have among many different people a sense that the border is something to be defended. In the case of like Argentina, for example, some of the people working for the national park there were suspicious of talking to me, because not only I was coming from the United States, but I also was Brazilian. So they were not, initially, they were not willing to talk to me about the national park, because They thought it was something that could be a breach of national security because I was not only a foreigner, but I was from Brazil, from across the border, asking all these questions. And when I asked rangers about collaboration, or asked also scientists about collaboration, they all told me that since the 1980s, you have collaboration happening informally at the lower levels. You have rangers doing patrols together. You have scientists doing some research together. Like you have, like, since the 1980s, I have all this research done on the carnivores and the pork, on jaguars and mountain lions there. And you have scientists from the two sides of the border working together. But at the level of the directors of the national parks, you don't have, like, at the formal level, we don't have that collaboration. And every time they try to do that, it didn't advance. It did because you have the people from the national park agencies on the two sides not being willing to do that collaboration. It did because legislation is different. It did because people are not willing to share their secrets or whatever. So you still have the sense that the parks are the last line of defense of national sovereignty, and people on the ground, they are willing to defend that idea.
Well, so thank you so much for talking about your book about nationalizing nature. I was wondering, what's next on the table for you? What are you working on now or in the future?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So my next project, I'm moving from the borderland to the center of the country, and I'm doing an environmental history of Brasilia, which is the modernist capital, national capital that was built by Brazil in the 1950s. People tend to think about Brasilia as this artificial construct, the city that was built from scratch in 5 years, following this modernist, high modernist design that tried to recreate Brazilian society from scratch and failed. And I'm trying to move a little bit beyond that to look at the role of nature in the construction of Brasilia. Brasilia was built on this area of Brazil that was a high altitude savanna. And the people who, the first proponents of Brasilia, they all came from the coast, from areas of Atlantic forest, and they were not used to this different type of environment, different type of landscape. So I'm trying to think about what kind of the ways in which they envisioned Brasilia, the ways in which they envisioned this new society, urban society, to relate with the natural environment that was to receive this city, and what happens after Brasilia was built in terms of, like, the modernist plan and the way it relate to the nature, from, like, the actual savanna to natural resources like water, to things like pollution and sanitation, these kind of things. That's my next project.
That's really fabulous. I love the idea of a natural history of this sort of modernist urban planning paradise. Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciate having you on the podcast. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm very happy to be here.